Beth strode past them, stepping neatly over the books. She opened the door and stepped outside, where her little brother was sitting on the steps, waiting. The women occasionally brought Bryn a poke of candies in return for running errands, and he looked up hopefully.
Bryn, go tell Mr. Van Cleve that Alice here has to stay late for a meeting on library policy and that we'll walk her home when we're done. Then head over to Mrs. Brady's and tell her the same. Actually, don't tell her it's library policy. She'll be down here faster than you can say Mrs. Lena B. Nofsier. Tell her we're cleaning our saddles. Then you tell Mama the same thing and I'll buy you a twist of Tootsie Rolls.
Marjorie narrowed her eyes. This had better not be...
I'll be right back. And hey, Bryn! Bryn! You tell Daddy I was smoking and I'll rip your damn ears off one after the other. You hear me?
What is going on? Said Alice as they heard Beth's footsteps disappear down the road.
I could ask the same thing, said a voice.
Marjorie looked up to see Sophia standing in the doorway, her hands clasped together and her bag tucked under her arm. One eyebrow rose at the sight of the chaos.
Oh, my days. You said it was bad. You didn't tell me I was going to want to run screaming back to Louisville.
Alice and Izzy stared at the tall woman in the immaculate blue dress. Sophia looked back at them.
Well, I don't know why you all are just sitting there catching flies. You should be working.
Sophia put down her bag and untied her scarf.
I told William and I'll tell you. I'll work the evenings and I'll do it with the door bolted so nobody's going to get aerated about me being here. Those are my terms. And I want the wage we discussed.
Fine by me, said Marjorie.
The two younger women, bemused, turned and looked at Marjorie. Marjorie smiled.
Izzy, Alice, this is Miss Sophia. This is our fifth librarian.
Sophia Kenworth, Marjorie advised them as they began to get to grips with the stacks of books, had spent 8 years at the Colored Library in Louisville, in a building so large that it had divided its books not just into sections, but into whole floors. It served professors, lecturers from Kentucky State University, and had a system of professionally produced cards and stamps that would be used to leave date marks when anything came in and out. Sophia had undergone formal training and an apprenticeship, and her job had only come to an end when her mother died and William had had his accident within 3 short months of each other, forcing her to leave Louisville to look after him.
That's what we need here, Sophia said as she sifted through the books, lifting each to examine its spine. We need systems. You leave it with me.
An hour later, the library doors were bolted, most of the books were off the floor, and Sophia was whisking through the pages of the ledger, making soft sounds of disapproval. Beth, meanwhile, had returned, and was now holding a large mason jar of colored liquid under Alice's nose.
I don't know, Alice said. Just sip it. Go on, it's not going to kill you. It's apple pie moonshine.
Alice looked at Marjorie, who had already declined. Nobody seemed surprised that Marjorie didn't drink moonshine. Alice raised the jar to her lips, hesitated, and lost her nerve again.
What's going to happen if I go home drunk?
Well, I guess you'll go home drunk, said Beth.
I don't know. Can someone else try it first?
Well, Izzy ain't going to, is she?
Says who? Said Izzy.
Oh boy, here we go,
said Beth, laughing. She took the jar from Alice's hands and passed it to Izzy. With an impish grin, Izzy took the jar in two hands and raised it to her mouth. She took a swig, coughing and spluttering, her eyes widening as she tried to hand the jar back.
You're not meant to be glugging it, said Beth,
and took a small sip.
You drink like that and you'll be blind by Tuesday.
Give it here, said Alice.
She looked down at the contents and took a breath.
You are too impulsive, Alice.
She took a sip, feeling the alcohol burn a mercury path down her throat. She clamped her eyes shut, waiting for them to stop watering. It was actually delicious.
Good?
Beth's mischievous eyes were on her when she opened them again. She nodded mutely and swallowed.
Surprisingly, she croaked. Yes, let me have another.
Something shifted in Alice that evening. She was tired of the eyes of the town on her, sick of being monitored and talked about and judged. She was sick of being married to a man whom everyone else thought was the good Lord Almighty and who could barely bring himself to look at her. Alice had come halfway across the world to find that, yet again, she was considered wanting. Well, she thought, if that was what everyone thought, she might as well live up to it. She took another sip, and then another, batting away Beth's hands when she shouted, "Steady now, girl!" She felt, she told them, when she finally handed it back, pleasantly squiffy.
"Pleasantly squiffy,"
Beth mimicked, and the girls fell about laughing. Marjorie smiled, despite herself.
"Well, I have no idea what kind of library this is," said Sophia from the corner.
"They just need to let off steam is all," said Marjorie. "They've been working hard."
"We have been working hard, and now we need music," said Beth, holding up a hand. "Let's fetch Mr. Geisler's gramophone. He'll lend it to us."
Marjorie shook her head. "Leave Fred out of it. He doesn't need to see this."
"You mean he doesn't need to see Alice all inebriated?" said Beth slyly.
"What?"
Alice looked up.
"Don't tease her," said Marjorie. "She's married anyway."
"In theory,"
muttered Alice, who was having trouble focusing.
"Yeah, just be like Marjorie and do what you want when you want."
Beth looked sideways at her.
"With who you want?" "You want me to be ashamed of how I live my life, Beth Pinker, because you'll be waiting halfway to the heavens falling down." "Hey," said Beth, "if I had a man as handsome as Sven Gustafson come a-courting me, I'd have a ring on my finger so fast he wouldn't even know how he'd found himself at church. You want to take a bite out of the apple before you put it in the basket, that's up to you. Just make sure you keep hold of the basket." "What if I don't want a basket?" "Everyone wants a basket." "Not me. Never have, never will. No basket."
"What are you all talking about?"
said Alice, and started to giggle.
"They lost me at Mr. Geisler," said Izzy, and belched quietly. "Good Lord, I feel amazing. I don't think I felt like this since I went on the Ferris wheel 3 times at Lexington County Fair, except, no, that didn't end well."
Alice leaned in toward Izzy and put a hand on her arm.
"I really am sorry about your strap, Izzy. I didn't mean to break it." "Oh, don't you worry. I'll just ask Mother to go get me another."
For some reason, they both found this hysterically funny. Sophia looked at Marjorie and raised an eyebrow. Marjorie lit the oil lamps that dotted the end of each shelf, trying not to smile. She wasn't really one for big groups, but she quite liked this, the jokes and the merriment, and the way that you could see actual friendships springing up around the room, like green shoots.
"Hey, girls,"
said Alice when she had got her giggles under control.
"What would you do if you could do anything you wanted?"
"Sort out this library," muttered Sophia.
"I'm serious. If you could do anything, be anything, what would you do?"
"I'd travel the world,"
said Beth, who had made herself a backrest of books and was now making armrests to go with it.
"I'd go to India and Africa and Europe and maybe Egypt and have me a little look around. I got no plans to stay around here my whole life. My brothers will have me minding my pa till he's dribbling. I want to see the Taj Mahal and the Great Wall of China and that place where they build little round huts out of ice blocks and a whole bunch of other places in the encyclopedias. I was going to say I'd go to England and meet the king and queen, but we got Alice, so we don't need to."
The other women started to laugh.
"Izzy?" "Oh, it's crazy."
"Crazier than Beth and her Taj Mahals?"
"Go on," said Alice, nudging her.
"I'd, well,
I'd be a singer, said Izzy. I'd sing on the wireless or on a gramophone record, like Dorothy L'Amour or...
She glanced toward Sophia, who did a good job of not raising her eyebrows too far.
Billie Holiday.
Surely your daddy could fix that for you. He knows everyone, don't he?
Said Beth. Izzy looked suddenly uncomfortable.
People like me don't become singers.
Why? Said Marjorie. You can't sing? That'll do it, said Beth.
You know what I mean.
Marjorie shrugged.
Last time I looked, you didn't need your leg to sing.
But people wouldn't listen. They'd be too busy staring at my brace.
Oh, don't flatter yourself, Izzy girl. Enough people got leg braces and whatnot around here. Or just...
She paused.
Wear a long dress.
What do you sing, Miss Izzy?
Said Sophia, who was arranging spines into alphabetical order. Izzy had sobered. Her skin was a little flushed.
Oh, I like hymns, bluegrass, blues, anything really. I even tried a little opera once.
Well, you gotta sing now, said Beth,
lighting a cigarette and blowing on her fingers when the match burned too low.
Come on, girl, show us what you got.
Oh, no, said Izzy. I only really sing for myself.
That's going to be some pretty empty concert hall then, said Beth.
Izzy looked at them. Then she pushed herself up onto her feet. She took a shaky breath, and then she began. My sweetheart's murmurs turned to dust, all tender kisses turned to rust. I'll hold him in my heart, though he be far, and turn my love to a midnight star. Her eyes closed, her voice filled the little room, soft and mellifluous, as if it had been dipped in honey. Izzy, right in front of them, began to change into someone quite new, her torso extending, her mouth opening wider to reach the notes. She was somewhere quite distant now, somewhere beloved to her. Beth rocked gently and began to smile. It stretched across her face, pure, unclouded delight at this unexpected turn of events. She let out a, "Hell yes!" as if she couldn't contain it. And then, after a moment, Sophia, as if compelled by an impulse she could barely control, began to join in, her own voice deeper, tracing the path of Izzy's and complimenting it. Izzy opened her eyes, and the two women smiled at each other as they sang, their voices lifting, their bodies swaying in time with the beat, and the air in the little library lifted with them. Its light is distant, but it warms me still. I'm a million miles from heaven, but I'll wait here till my sweetheart comes again, and the glow I feel is brighter than the stars above Kentucky hills. Alice watched, the moonshine coursing through her blood, the warmth and music making her nerves sing, and felt something give inside her, something she hadn't wanted to acknowledge to herself, something primal to do with love and loss and loneliness. She looked at Marjorie, whose expression had relaxed, lost in her own private reverie, and thought of Beth's comments about a man Marjorie never discussed. Perhaps conscious she was being watched, Marjorie turned to her and smiled, and Alice realized, with horror, that tears were sliding unchecked down her cheeks. Marjorie's raised eyebrows were a silent question. Just a little homesick, Alice answered. It was the truth, she thought. She just wasn't sure she had yet been to the place she was homesick for. Marjorie took her elbow, and they stepped outside into the dusk, hopping down into the paddock where the horses grazed peacefully by the fence, oblivious to the noise inside. Marjorie handed Alice her handkerchief. You okay? Alice blew her nose. She had begun to sober immediately, out in the cool air.
Fine, fine.
She looked up at the skies.
Actually, no, not really.
Can I help?
I don't think it's something anyone else can help with,
Marjorie leaned back against the wall so that she was looking up at the mountains behind them.
There's not much I haven't seen and heard these 38 years. I'm pretty sure whatever you have to say isn't going to knock me off my heels.
Alice closed her eyes. If she put it out there, it became real, a living, breathing thing that she would have to do something about. Her gaze flickered to Marjorie and away again.
And if you think I'm the type to go talking, Alice Van Cleave, you really haven't worked me out at all.
Mr. Van Cleave keeps going on about us not having any babies.
Hell, that's just standard round here. The moment you put a ring on that finger, they're all just counting down.
But that's just it. It's Bennett.
Alice wrung her hands together.
It's been months, and he won't.
Marjorie let the words settle. She waited, as if to check that she had heard right.
He won't.
Alice took a deep breath.
It all started well enough. We'd been waiting so long, what with the journey and everything, and actually it was lovely. And then just as things were about to, well, Mr. Van Cleave shouted something through the wall. I think he thought he was being encouraging, and we were both a little startled, and then everything stopped, and I opened my eyes, and Bennett wasn't even looking at me, and he seemed so cross and distant, and when I asked him if everything was okay, he told me I was...
She gulped.
Unladylike, for asking.
Marjorie waited.
So I lay back down and waited, and he... Well, I thought it was going to happen, but then we could hear Mr. Van Cleave clomping around next door, and, well, that was that. And I tried to whisper something, but he got cross and acted like it was my fault. But I don't really know, because I've never... So I can't be sure whether it's something I'm doing wrong or he's doing wrong, but either way, his father is always next door and the walls are so thin and, well, Bennett, he just acts like I'm something he doesn't want to get too close to anymore. And it's not like it's one of those things you can talk about.
The words tumbled out, unchecked. She felt her face flood with color.
I want to be a good wife, I really do. It just feels impossible.
So... Let me get this straight. You haven't...
I don't know, because I don't know what it's supposed to be like.
She shook her head, then covered her face with her hands, as if horrified that she was even saying the words out loud. Marjorie frowned at her boots.
Stay there, she said.
She disappeared into the cabin, where the singing had reached a new pitch. Alice listened anxiously, fearing the sudden cessation of voices that would suggest Marjorie had betrayed her. But instead, the song lifted, and a little burst of applause met a musical flourish, and she heard Beth's muffled whoop. Then the door opened, allowing the voices to swell briefly, and Marjorie tripped back down the steps, holding a small blue book, which she handed to Alice.
Okay. So, this doesn't go in the ledger. This, we pass around to ladies who, perhaps, need a little help in some of the matters you've mentioned.
Alice stared at the leather-bound book.
It's just facts. I promised it to a woman over at Miller's Creek on my Monday route, but you can take a look over the weekend and see if there's anything in there might help.
Alice flicked through, startling at the words sex, naked, womb. She blushed.
This goes out with the library books.
Let's just say it's an unofficial part of our service, given it has a bit of a checkered history through our courts. It doesn't exist in the ledger, and it doesn't sit out on the shelves. We just keep it between ourselves.
Have you read it?
Cover to cover, and more than once. And I can tell you it has brought me a good deal of joy.
She raised an eyebrow and smiled.
And not just me, either.
Alice blinked. She couldn't imagine prizing joy out of her current situation, no matter how hard she tried.
Good evening, ladies.
The two women turned to see Fred Geisler walking down the path toward them, an oil lamp in his hand.
Sounds like quite a party.
Alice hesitated and thrust the book abruptly back at Marjorie.
I... I don't think so. It's just facts, Alice. Nothing more than that.
Alice walked briskly past her back to the library.
I can manage this myself. Thank you.
She half ran back up the steps, the door slamming as she entered. Fred stopped when he reached Marjorie. She noted the faint disappointment in his expression.
Something I said?
Not even halfway close, Fred, she said, and placed a hand on his arm. But why don't you come on in and join us? Aside from a few extra bristles on that chin of yours, you're pretty much an honorary librarian yourself.
She would have laid down money, said Beth afterward, that that was the finest librarians' meeting that had ever taken place in Lee County. Izzy and Sophia had sung their way through every song they could recall, teaching each other the ones they didn't know and making up a few on the spot, their voices wild and raucous as they grew in confidence, stamping and hollering, the girls clapping in time. Fred Geisler, who had indeed been happy to fetch his gramophone, had been persuaded to dance with each of them, his tall frame stooped to accommodate Izzy, disguising her limp with some well-timed swings so that she lost her awkwardness and laughed until tears leaked from her eyes. Alice smiled and tapped along, but wouldn't meet Marjorie's eye, as if she were already mortified at having revealed so much, and Marjorie understood that she would simply have to say nothing and wait for the girl's feelings of exposure and humiliation, however unwarranted, to die down. And amid all this, Sophia would sing out and sway her hips as if even her rigor and reserve could not hold out against the music. Fred, who had declined all offers of moonshine, had driven them home in the dark, all crammed into the back seat of his truck, taking Sophia first under cover of the rest, and they had heard her singing still as she tapped her way down the path to the neat little house at Monarch Creek. They had dropped Izzy next, the motor car's tires spinning in the huge driveway, and had seen Mrs. Brady's amazement at her daughter's sweaty hair and grinning face.
I never had friends like you all before, Izzy had exclaimed as they flew along the dark road, and they knew that it was only half moonshine talking. Honestly, I never even thought I liked other girls till I became a librarian.
She had hugged each of them with a child's giddy enthusiasm. Alice had sobered completely by the time they dropped her off and said little. The two Van Cleve men were seated on the porch, despite the chill in the air and the late hour, and Marjorie detected a distinct reluctance in her step as Alice made her way slowly up the path toward them. Neither rose from his seat. Nobody smiled under the flickering porch light or leaned forward to greet her. Marjorie and Fred drove the rest of the way to her cabin in silence, each lost in their own thoughts.
Tell Sven I said hey, he said, as she opened the gate and Bluey came bounding down the slope to meet her. I will. He's a good man.
As are you. You need to find yourself someone else, Fred. It's been long enough.
He opened his mouth as if to speak, then closed it again.
You have a good rest of your evening,
he said finally, and tipped his forehead as if he were still wearing a hat, then turned the wheel and drove back down the road. Chapter 7. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, agents for land companies had swept through the Kentucky mountain region, buying up mineral rights from residents, sometimes for as little as 50 cents per acre. The broad form deeds often signed over the rights to dump, store, and leave upon said land any and all muck, bone, shale, water, or other refuse, to use and pollute watercourses in any manner, and to do anything necessary and convenient to extract subsurface minerals. Chad Montree, The Environment and Environmental Activism in Appalachia.
The prince told her she was the most beautiful girl he had ever seen, and then he asked if she would marry him, and they all lived happily ever after.
May Horner brought the two sides of the book briskly together with a satisfying slap.
That was really very good, May.
I read it through 4 times yesterday after I collected the wood.
Well, it shows. I do believe your reading is as good as any girl's in this county.
She's smart, all right.
Alice looked up to where Jim Horner stood in the doorway.
Like her mama. Her mama could read since she was 3 years old. Grew up in a house full of books over near Paintsville.
I can read too,
said Millie, who had been sitting by Alice's feet.
I know you can, Millie, said Alice. And your reading is very good too. Honestly, Mr. Horner, I don't think I've ever met 2 children take to it like yours have.
He suppressed a smile.
Tell her what you did, May, he said.
The girl looked at him, just to check for her father's approval.
Go on.
I made a pie.
You made a pie? By yourself?
From a recipe in that Country Home magazine you left us. A peach pie. I would offer you a slice, but we ate it all.
Millie giggled.
Daddy ate 3 pieces.
I was hunting up in Northridge, and she got the old range going and everything. And I walked in the door, and there was a smell like...
He lifted his nose and closed his eyes, recalling the scent. His face briefly lost its habitual hardness.
I walked in, and there she was, with it all laid out on the table. She had followed every one of those instructions to a T.
I did burn the edges a little.
Well, your mama always did the same.
The three of them sat in silence for a moment.
A peach pie, said Alice. I'm not sure we can keep up with you, young May. What can I leave you girls this week?
Did Black Beauty come in yet?
It did, and I remembered what you said about wanting it, so I brought it with me. How about that? Now, the words in this one are a little longer, so you may find it a little harder, and it's sad in places.
Jim Horner's expression changed.
I mean, for the horses. There are some sad bits for the horses. The horses talk. It's not easy to explain.
Maybe I can read to you, Daddy.
My eyes ain't too good, he explained. Can't seem to aim the way I used to, but we get by.
I can see that.
Alice sat in the center of the little cabin that had once spooked her so much. May, although only 11, appeared to have taken charge of it, sweeping and organizing, so that where it had once seemed bleak and dark, there was now a distinct homeliness, with a bowl of apples in the center of the table and a quilt across the chair. She packed up her books and confirmed that everyone was happy with what she had brought. Millie hugged her around her neck, and she held her fiercely. It was some time since anybody had pulled her close, and it provoked strange, conflicting feelings.
It's a whole 7 days until we see you again,
the girl announced solemnly. Her hair smelled of wood smoke and something sweet that existed only in the forest. Alice breathed it in.
It certainly is, and I can't wait to see how much you've read in the meantime.
Millie, this one's got drawings in it too,
May called from the floor. Millie released Alice and hunkered down by her sister. Alice watched them for a moment, then made her way to the door, shrugging on her coat, a once fashionable tweed blazer that was now scuffed with moss and mud and sprouted messy threads where it had caught on bushes and branches. The mountain had grown distinctly colder these last days, as if winter were settling into its foundations.
Miss Alice?
Yes?
The girls were bent over Black Beauty, Millie's finger tracing the words as her sister read aloud. Jim looked behind him, as if making sure their focus was elsewhere.
I wanted to apologize.
Alice, who had been tying her scarf, stopped.
After my wife passed, I was not myself for a while. Felt like the sky was falling in, you know? And I was not hospitable when you first came by. But these last couple of months, seeing the girls stop crying for their mama, giving them something to look forward to every week, it's, well, I just wanted to say it's much appreciated.
Alice held her hands in front of her. Mr. Horner, I can honestly tell you that I look forward to seeing your girls just as much as they look forward to my visits.
Well, it's good for them to see a lady. I didn't realize till my Betsy was gone how much a child misses the more feminine side of things.
He scratched his head.
They talk about you, you know, how you speak and all. May there says she wants to be a librarian.
She does?
Made me realize, I can't keep them close by me forever. I want more for them than this, you know, seeing as how smart they both are.
He stood silent for a moment. Then he said,
Miss Alice, what do you think of that school, the one with the German lady?
Mrs. Baedecker, Mr. Horner, I think your girls would love her.
She doesn't take a switch to the children? You hear some things. Betsy got beat something awful at school, so she never wanted the girls to go.
I'd be happy to introduce you to her, Mr. Horner. She is a kind woman, and the students seem to love her. I cannot believe she would ever lay a hand on a child. He considered this.
It's hard,
he said, looking out at the mountain.
Having to work all this stuff out. I thought I'd be just doing a man's job. My own daddy just brought home the food and put his feet up and let my mama do all the rest. And now I have to be mother as well as father, make all these decisions.
Look at those girls, Mr. Horner. They glanced to where the girls, now lying on their stomachs, were exclaiming over something they had just read. Alice smiled. I think you're doing fine. Finn Mayberg, Upper Pinch Me, one copy The Furrow, dated May 1937. Two copies Weird Tales Magazine, dated December 1936 and February 1937. Ellen Prince, Eagle's Top, End Cabin, Little Women by Louisa May Alcott. From Farm to Table by Edna Rodin. Nancy and Phyllis Stone, Arnott's Ridge, Mac McGuire and the Indian Girl by Amherst Archer. Mac McGuire Takes a Fall by Amherst Archer. Note, they have read all current editions. Ask if we can find out if there are any more. Marjorie flicked through the ledger, Sophia's elegant handwriting neatly transcribing date and routes at the top of each page. Beside it sat a pile of newly repaired books, their bindings stitched and the torn covers patched with pages from books that couldn't be salvaged. Beside that lay a new scrapbook, the Baileyville Bonus, this edition comprising 4 pages of recipes from spoiled copies of The Woman's Home Companion, a short story titled What She Wouldn't Say, and a long feature about collecting ferns. The library was now immaculate, a system of labels marking the back of every shelved book so that it was easy for them to find their place, the books precisely ordered and categorized. Sophia would come by at around 5 p.m. and would usually have done a couple of hours by the time the girls returned from their routes. The days were growing shorter now, so they were having to return earlier because of the falling light. Sometimes they would all just sit and chat among themselves while unloading their bags and comparing their days before they headed off to their homes. Fred had been installing a wood burner in the corner in his free time, though it wasn't finished yet. The gap around the flue pipe was still stuffed with rags to stop the rain coming in. Despite this, all the women seemed to find reasons to hang around a little later each day, and Marjorie suspected that once the stove started up, she would have trouble persuading them to go home. Mrs. Brady looked a little startled when Marjorie explained the identity of the newest member of their team, but, having seen the altered state of the little building, to her credit, she simply compressed her lips and raised her fingers to her temples.
Has anybody complained?
Nobody's seen her to complain. She comes in the back by Mr. Geisler's house and goes home the same way.
Mrs. Brady mulled this for a moment.
Are you familiar with what Mrs. Knofseer says? You know of Mrs. Knofseer, of course.
Marjorie smiled.
They all knew of Mrs. Knopfseer. Mrs. Brady would shoehorn her name into a conversation about horse liniment if she could.
Well, I was recently lucky enough to attend an address for teachers and parents that the good lady gave where she said, hold on, I wrote this bit down.
She riffled through her pocketbook.
A library service should be provided for all people, rural as well as urban, colored as well as white. There, colored as well as white. That was how she put it. I believe we have to be mindful of the importance of progress and equality, just as Mrs. Knopfseer is. So you'll have no objection from me about employing a colored woman here.
She rubbed at a mark on the desk, then examined her finger.
Maybe we won't actually advertise it just yet, though. There's no need to invite controversy, given we're such a fledgling venture. I'm sure you catch my drift.
My feelings exactly, Mrs. Brady, Marjorie said. I wouldn't want to bring trouble to Sophia's door.
She does a beautiful job, I'll give her that.
Mrs. Brady gazed around her. Sophia had stitched a sampler, which hung on the wall beside the door. To seek knowledge is to expand your own universe, and Mrs. Brady patted it with some satisfaction.
I have to say, Miss O'Hare, I am immensely proud of what you have achieved in just a few short months. It has exceeded all our expectations. I have written to Mrs. Knopfseer to tell her as much several times, and I am sure that at some point she will be passing on those sentiments to Mrs. Roosevelt herself. It is a profound shame not everyone in our town feels the same way.
She glanced away, as if deciding not to say more.
But, as I said, I do believe this is a true model of a pack horse library, and you girls should be proud of yourselves.
Marjorie nodded. It was probably best not to tell Mrs. Brady about the library's unofficial initiative. Each day she sat down at the desk in the dark hours between her arrival and dawn, and she wrote out, according to her template, a half dozen more of the letters that she had been distributing to the inhabitants of Northridge. Dear neighbor, it has come to our attention that the owners of Hoffman are seeking to create new mines in your neighborhood. This would involve the removal of hundreds of acres of timber, the blasting of new pits, and, in many cases, the loss of homes and livelihoods. I write to you in confidence, as the mines are known to employ devious and harsh individuals in the interests of getting their way, but I believe that it is both illegal and immoral for them to do what they plan, that it would be the cause of abject misery and destitution. To that end, according to law books we have consulted, there appears to be a precedent to stop such wholesale rape of our landscape and protect our homes, and I urge you to read this extract provided below, or, if you have the resources, to consult the legal representative at Baileyville's court offices in order to put such obstructions in place as may be required to prevent this destruction. In the meantime, do not sign any broad form deeds, for these, despite the money and assurances offered, will give the mine owners the right to mine under your very house. If help is needed with the reading of such documents, the pack horse librarians may be happy to assist and will, of course, do so with discretion. In confidence, a friend. She finished, folded them neatly, and placed one in each of the saddlebags, except Alice's. She would deliver the extra one herself. No point making things more complicated for the girl than they already were. The boy had finally stopped screaming, his voice now emerging as a series of barely suppressed whimpers, as if he had remembered himself to be among men. His clothes and skin were equally black from where the coal had almost buried him, only the whites of his eyes visible to betray his shock and pain. Sven watched as the stretcher bearers lifted him carefully, their job made harder by the low pitch of the roof, and, stooping, began to shuffle out, shouting instructions at each other as they went. Sven leaned back against the rough wall to let them pass, then turned his light on those miners who were setting up props where the roof had fallen, cursing as they struggled to wedge the heavy timbers into place. This was low-vein coal, the chambers of the mine so shallow in places that men were barely able to rise onto their knees. It was the worst kind of mining. Sven had friends who were crippled by the time they were 30, reliant on sticks just to stand straight. He hated these rabbit warrens, where your mind would play tricks in the near dark to tell you the damp, black expanse above your head was even now closing in on you. He had seen too many sudden roof falls, and only a pair of boots left visible to judge where the body might be.
Boss, you might want to take a look through here.
Sven looked round, itself a tricky maneuver, and followed Jim McNeil's beckoning glove. The underground chambers were connected rather than reached through new shafts from the outside, not uncommon in a mine where the owner championed profit over safety. He made his way awkwardly along the passage to the next chamber and adjusted his helmet light. Some 8 props stood in a shallow opening, each buckling visibly under the weight of the roof above it. He moved his head slowly, scanning the empty space, the black surface glittering around him as it was met by the carbide lamplight.
Can you see how many they took out? Looks like about half remaining.
Sven cursed.
Don't go any farther in,
he said, and twisting, turned to the men behind him.
No man is to go into number 2. You hear me? You tell Van Cleave that, said a voice behind him. You gotta cross number 2 to get to number 8. Then nobody is to go into number 8. Not till everything's shored up right. He ain't going to hear that. Oh, he'll hear it.
The air was thick with dust, and he spat behind him, his lower back already aching. He turned to the miners.
We need at least 10 more props in 7 before anyone goes back in, and get your fire boss to check for methane before anyone starts work again.
There was a murmur of agreement, Gustafson being one of the few authority figures a miner could trust to be on his side, and Sven motioned his team into the haulage way and then outside, already grateful for the prospect of sunlight.
So, what's the damage, Gustafson?
Sven stood in Van Cleave's office, his nostrils still filled with the smell of sulfur, his boots leaving a fine, dusty outline on the thick red carpet, waiting for Van Cleave in his pale suit to look up from his paperwork. Across the room, he could see young Bennett glance up from behind his desk, his blue cotton shirt sleeves marked with a neat crease. The younger man never looked quite comfortable at the mine. He rarely stepped out of the administrative block, as if the dirt and unpredictable nature of it were anathema to him.
Well, we got the boy out, though it was a close thing. His hip's pretty bust. That's excellent news. I'm much obliged to you all. I've had him taken to the company doctor. Yes, yes, very good.
Van Cleave appeared to believe that was the end of the conversation. He flashed a smile at Sven, holding it a moment too long, as if to question why he was still standing there, then shuffled his papers emphatically. Sven waited a beat.
You might want to know what caused the roof fall. Oh, yes, of course. Looks like props holding up the roof have been moved from the mined-out area in number 2 to support the new chamber in 7. It destabilized the whole area.
Van Cleave's expression, when he finally looked up again, betrayed exactly the manufactured surprise Sven had known it would.
Well now, the men should not be reusing props. We have told them as much many a time, haven't we, Bennett?
Bennett, behind his desk, looked down, too cowardly even to tell a straight lie. Sven swallowed the words he wanted to say and considered those that followed carefully.
Sir, I should also point out that the amount of coal dust on the ground is a hazard in every one of your mines. You need more non-combustible rock atop it, and better ventilation if you want to avoid more incidents.
Van Cleave scribbled something on a piece of paper, He no longer appeared to be listening.
Mr. Van Cleve, of all the mines our safety crew serves, I have to inform you that Hoffman's conditions are by some distance the least satisfactory.
Yes, yes, I have told the men as such. Goodness knows why they won't just get on and rectify matters. But let's not make too big of a deal of it, Gustafson. It's a temporary oversight. Bennett will get the foreman up and we'll sort it out. Won't you, Bennett?
Sven might reasonably have pointed out that Van Cleve had said exactly this the last time the sirens had gone off some 18 days previously because of an explosion in the entrance of Number 9, caused by a young breaker who hadn't known not to go in with an open light. The boy had been lucky to escape with superficial burns, but workers came cheap after all.
Anyway, all's well, thank the Lord.
Van Cleve lifted himself with a grunt from his chair and walked around his large mahogany desk toward the door, signifying that the meeting was over.
Thank you and your men for your service as ever. Worth every cent our mine pays toward your team.
Sven didn't move. Van Cleve opened the door. A long, painful moment passed. Sven faced him.
Mr. Van Cleve, you know I'm not a political man, but you must understand that it's conditions like these here that give root to those agitating for union membership.
Van Cleve's face darkened.
I hope you're not suggesting.
Sven lifted his palms.
I have no affiliation. I just want your workers to be safe. But I have to say it would be a shame if this mine were considered too dangerous for my men to come here. I'm sure that would not go down well in the locality.
The smile, half-hearted as it was, had now vanished completely.
Well, I'm sure I thank you for your advice, Gustafson. And as I said, I will get my men to attend to it. Now, if you don't mind, I have pressing matters to attend to. The foreman will fetch you and your crew any water you might need.
Van Cleve continued to hold the door. Sven nodded, then, as he passed, thrust out a blackened hand so that the older man, after a moment's hesitation, was forced to take it. After clasping it firmly enough to be sure he would have left some kind of imprint, at least, Sven released it and walked away down the corridor. With the first frost in Baileyville came hog slaughtering time. The mere words made Alice, who couldn't tread on a bug, feel a little faint, especially when Beth described, with relish, what happened in her own home each year. The stunning of the squealing pig, the slitting of its throat as the boys sat hard on it, its legs pumping furiously, the hot, dark blood pouring out onto the scraping board. She mimed the men tipping scalding water over it, attacking the bristles with flat blades, reducing the animal to flesh and gristle and bone.
My Aunt Lena will be waiting there with her apron open, ready to catch the head. She makes the best souse, that's from the tongue, ears, and feet, this side of the Cumberland Gap. But my favorite part of the whole day, since I was small, is when Daddy tips all the innards into a tub and we get to choose the best bit to roast. I'd elbow my brothers in the eye to get to that old liver, put it on a stick, and roast it in the fire. Oh, boy, nothing like it. Fresh roasted hog liver. Mm-mm.
She laughed as Alice covered her mouth and shook her head mutely. But, like Beth, the town seemed to greet the prospect with an almost unseemly relish, and everywhere they went, the librarians were offered a lick of salt bacon, or, on one occasion, hog brains scrambled with egg, a mountain delicacy. Alice's stomach still turned at the thought of that. But it wasn't just the hog slaughtering that was causing a frisson of anticipation to run through the town. Tex Lafayette was coming. Posters of the white-clad cowboy clutching his bullwhip were all over town, tacked hastily onto posts and scrutinized by small boys and lovelorn women alike. At every other settlement, the name of the singing cowboy was spoken like a talisman, followed by, "Is it true? Are you going?" Demand was so great that he was no longer booked to appear in the theater, as originally planned, but would perform in the town square, where a stage was already being constructed from old pallets and planks, and for days beforehand, whooping boys would run across it, imitating playing a banjo, ducking their heads to avoid the flat hands of the irritated workmen as they passed.
"Can we finish early tonight? Not like anyone's going to be reading. Everyone for 10 miles yonder's already headed to the square," said Beth as she pulled her last book from her saddlebag. "Shoot. Look at what those Mackenzie boys have done to poor old Treasure Island."
She stooped to pick up the scattered pages from the floor, cursing.
"Don't see why not," said Marjorie. "Sophia has it all under control, and it's dark already anyhow."
"Who is Tex Lafayette?" said Alice.
The four women turned and stared at her.
"Who is Tex Lafayette? Haven't you seen Green Grows My Mountain? Or Corral My Heart?"
"Oh, I love Corral My Heart. That song near the end just about broke me," said Izzy, and let out a huge, happy sigh.
"You didn't have to trap me, for I'm your willing prisoner," broke in Sophia. "You didn't need a rope to corral my heart," they sang in unison, each lost in a reverie. Alice looked blank.
"You don't go to the picture house?" said Izzy. "Tex Lafayette has been in everything.
He can bullwhip a lit cigarette out of a man's mouth and not leave a scratch on him.
He is a grade A dreamboat."
"I'm too tired to go out most evenings. Bennett goes sometimes." In truth, Alice would have found it too strange to be beside her husband in the dark now. She suspected he felt the same way. For weeks, they had taken care that their lives crossed as little as possible. She was gone long before breakfast, and he was often out for dinner, either on work errands for Mr. Van Cleve or playing baseball with his friends. He spent most nights on the daybed in their dressing room, so that even the shape of him had become unfamiliar to her. If Mr. Van Cleve thought there was anything odd about their behavior, he didn't say. He spent most of his evenings late at the mine, and seemed largely preoccupied with whatever was going on there. Alice now hated that house with a passion, its gloom, its stifling history. She was so grateful not to have to spend her evenings stuck in the dark little parlor with the two of them, that she didn't care to question any of it.
"You're coming to Tex Lafayette, right?"
Beth brushed her hair and straightened her blouse in the mirror. Apparently, she had a thing for a boy from the gas station, but had shown him her affection by punching him twice on the arm, hard, and was now at a loss to work out what to do next.
"Oh, I don't think so. I don't really know anything about him."
"All work and no play, Alice. Come on, the whole town is going. Izzy's going to meet us outside the store, and her mama has given her a whole dollar for cotton candy. It's only 50 cents if you want a seat, or you can stand back and watch for free. That's what we're doing."
"I don't know. Bennett's working late over at Hoffman. I should probably just go home."
Sophia and Izzy started to sing again, Izzy blushing as she always did when she found herself singing to an audience. "Your smile's a rope around me, has been since you found me. You didn't need to chase me to corral my heart." Marjorie took the small mirror from Beth and checked her face for smudges, rubbing at her cheekbone with a moistened handkerchief until she was satisfied.
"Well, Sven and I are going to be over by the nice and quick. He's reserved us an upstairs table so we can get a good view. You'd be welcome to join us."
"I have things to do here," said Alice. "But thank you. I may join you later."
She said it to mollify them, and they knew it. Secretly, she wanted just to sit in peace in the little library. She liked to be on her own there in the evenings, to read by herself in the dim light of the oil lamp, escaping to the tropical white of Robinson Crusoe's Island or the fusty corridors of Mr. Chips's Brookfield School. If Sophia came while she was still there, she tended to let Alice alone, interrupting only to ask if Alice might place her finger on this piece of fabric while she put in a couple of stitches, or whether she thought this repaired book cover looked acceptable. Sophia was not a woman who required an audience, but seemed to feel easier in company, so although they said little to each other, the arrangement had suited both of them for the past few weeks.
Okay, we'll see you later then.
With a cheery wave, the two women clumped across the boards and out down the steps, still in their breeches and boots. As the door opened, a swell of anticipatory noise carried into the little room. The square was full already, a local group of musicians fiddling to keep the waiting crowds happy, the air thick with laughter and catcalling.
You're not going, Sophia? Said Alice.
I'll have a listen out the back later on, said Sophia. Wind's carrying this way.
She threaded a needle, lifted another damaged book, and added quietly,
I'm not crazy about places where there are crowds.
Perhaps as a kind of concession, Sophia propped the back door open with a book and allowed the sound of the fiddle to creep in, her foot finding it impossible not to tap along occasionally. Alice sat on the chair in the corner, her writing paper on her lap, trying to compose a letter to Gideon, but her pen kept stilling in her hand. She had no idea what to tell him. Everyone in England believed she was enjoying an exciting, cosmopolitan life in an America full of huge cars and high times. She didn't know how to convey to her brother the truth of her situation. Behind her, Sophia, who seemed to know the tunes to everything, hummed along with the fiddle, sometimes allowing her voice to act as a descant, sometimes adding a few lyrics. Her voice was soft and velvety and soothing. Alice put down her pen and thought a little wistfully of how nice it would be to be out there with her husband of old, the one who had taken her in his arms and whispered lovely things in her ears, and whose eyes had promised a future full of laughter and romance, instead of the one she caught looking at her occasionally with bemusement, as if he couldn't work out how she had got there.
Good evening, ladies.
The door closed gently behind Fred Geisler. He was wearing a neatly pressed blue shirt and suit trousers and removed his hat at the sight of them. Alice startled slightly at the unexpected sight of him without his habitual checked shirt and overalls.
Saw the light was on, but I have to say I didn't expect to find you in here this evening. Not with our local entertainment and all.
Oh, I'm not really a fan, said Alice, who folded away her writing pad.
You can't be persuaded? Even if you don't enjoy cowboy tricks, Tex Lafayette has a heck of a voice, and it's a beautiful evening out there. Too beautiful to spend in here.
That's very kind, but I'm just fine here. Thank you, Mr. Geisler.
Alice waited for him to ask the same of Sophia, then grasped, with a slightly sick feeling, that of course it was obvious to everyone but her why he wouldn't, why the others hadn't pressed her to go with them either. A square full of drunk and rowdy young white men would not be a safe place for Sophia. She realized suddenly that she wasn't entirely sure what was a safe place for Sophia.
Well, I'm going to take a little stroll down to watch, but I'll stop by later and drive you home, Miss Sophia. There's a fair bit of liquor flying around that square tonight, and I'm not sure it'll be a pleasant place for a lady come 9 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Geisler, said Sophia. I appreciate it.
You should go, said Sophia, not looking up from her stitching as the sound of Fred's footsteps faded down the dark road.
Alice shuffled some loose sheets of paper.
It's complicated.
Life is complicated, which is why finding a little joy where you can is important.
She frowned at one of her stitches and unpicked it.
It's hard to be different from everyone around here. I understand that, I really do. I had a very different life in Louisville.
She let out a sigh.
But those girls care about you. They are your friends, and you shutting yourself off from them ain't going to make things any easier.
Alice watched as a moth fluttered around the oil lamp. After a moment, unable to bear it, she cupped it carefully in her hands, walked to the partially open door, and released it.
You'd be here by yourself.
I'm a big girl, and Mr. Geisler's going to come back for me.
She could hear the music starting up in the square, the roar of approval that announced the singing cowboy had taken center stage. She looked at the window.
You really think I should go?
Sophia put down her stitching.
Lord, Alice, you need me to write a song about it?
Hey, she called as Alice made for the front door.
Let me fix up your hair before you go. Appearances are important.
Alice ran back and held up the little mirror. She rubbed at her face with her handkerchief as Sophia ran a comb through her hair, pinning and tutting as she worked with nimble fingers. When Sophia stood back, Alice reached into her bag for her lipstick and drew coral pink over her lips, pursing them and rubbing them together. Satisfied, she looked down, brushing at her shirt and breeches.
Not much I can do about what I'm wearing.
But the top half is pretty as a picture, and that's all anyone will notice.
Alice smiled.
Thank you, Sophia.
You come back and tell me all about it.
She sat back at the desk and resumed tapping her foot, half lost already in the distant music. Alice was partway up the road when she glimpsed the creature. It scuttled across the shadowy road, and her mind, already a quarter mile ahead at the square, took a moment to register that something was in front of her. She slowed. A ground squirrel. She felt, oddly, as if the talk of all the murdered hogs had hung a sad fog over the week, adding to her vague sense of depression. For people who lived so deep in nature, the inhabitants of Baileyville seemed oblivious to the idea of respecting it. She stopped, waiting for the squirrel to cross in front of her. It was a large one, with a huge, thick tail. At that moment, the moon emerged from a cloud, revealing to her that it wasn't a squirrel after all, but something darker, more solid, with a black and white stripe. She frowned at it, perplexed, and then, as she was about to take a step forward, it turned its back on her, raised its tail, and she felt her skin sprayed with moisture. It took a second for that sensation to be supplanted by the most noxious smell she had ever breathed. She gasped and gagged, covering her mouth and spluttering, but there was no escaping it. It was all over her hands, her shirt, in her hair. The creature scuttled off nonchalantly into the night, leaving Alice batting at her clothes, as if by waving her hands and yelling, she could make it all go away. The upper floor of the Nisenquick was thick with bodies pressed against the window, three deep, some yelling their appreciation for the white-suited cowboy below. Marjorie and Sven were the only ones left seated, the two in a booth beside each other, as they preferred. Between them were the dregs of two iced teas. 2 weeks previously, a local photographer had stopped by and persuaded the ladies onto their horses in front of the WPA Packhorse Library sign, and all four, Izzy, Marjorie, Alice, and Beth, had posed shoulder to shoulder on their mounts. A copy of that photograph now took pride of place on the wall of the diner, the women gazing out, decorated by a string of streamers, and Marjorie could not take her eyes off it. She wasn't sure she had ever been prouder of anything in her life.
My brother's talking of buying some of that land up on Northridge. Boar McAllister says he'll give him a good price. I was thinking I might go in with him. I can't work down those mines forever.
She pulled her attention back to Sven.
How much land you talking about? About 400 acres. There's good hunting.
You haven't heard, then.
Heard what?
Marjorie reached round and pulled the template letter out of her bag. Sven opened it carefully and read it, placing it back on the table in front of her.
Where'd you hear this?
Know anything about it?
Nope. Everywhere we go, they're all about busting the United Mine Workers of America's influence just now.
The two things go together. I worked it out. Daniel McGraw, Ed Sidley, the Bray brothers, all those union organizers, they all live on Northridge. If the new mine shakes those men out of their homes, along with their families, it's that much harder for them to get organized. They don't want to end up like Harlan, with a damn war going on between the miners and their bosses. Sven leaned back in his seat. He blew out his cheeks and studied Marjorie's expression.
I'm guessing the letter is you.
She smiled sweetly at him. He ran a palm across his forehead.
Jeez, Marge. You know what those thugs are like. Is trouble actually in your blood? No, don't answer that.
I can't stand by while they wreck these mountains, Sven. You know what they did over at Great White Gap?
Yes, I do.
Blew the valley to pieces, polluted the water, and disappeared overnight when all the coal was gone. All those families left without jobs or homes. They won't do it over here.
He picked up the letter and read it again.
Anyone else know about this?
I got two families headed over to the legal offices already. I looked up legal books that say the mine owners can't blow up land if the families didn't sign those broad form contracts that give the mines all the rights. Casey Campbell helped her daddy to read all the paperwork.
She sighed with satisfaction, jabbing her finger onto the table.
Nothing more dangerous than a woman armed with a little knowledge, even if she's 12 years old. If anyone at Hoffman finds out it's you, there's going to be trouble.
She shrugged and took a swig of her drink.
I'm serious. Be careful, Marge. I don't want nothing happening to you. Van Cleve has bad men on his payroll on the back of this union fight, guys from out of town. You've seen what's happened in Harlan. I couldn't bear it if anything happened to you.
She peered up at him.
You're not getting sentimental on me, are you, Gustafson? I mean it.
He turned so that his face was inches from hers.
I love you, Marge.
She was about to joke, but there was an unfamiliar look to his face, something serious and vulnerable, and the words stilled on her lips. His eyes searched hers, and his fingers closed around her own, as if his hand might say what he wasn't able to. She held his gaze, and then, as a roar went up in the diner, she looked away. Below them, Tex Lafayette struck up with I Was Born in the Valley to loud whoops of approval.
Oh boy, those girls are going to go hog wild now, she murmured. I think what you meant to say is I love you too, he said after a minute.
Those dynamite sticks have done something to your ears. I'm sure I said it ages ago, she said,
and shaking his head, he pulled her toward him again and kissed her until she stopped grinning. It didn't matter where they'd said they were going to meet, Alice thought, as she fought her way through the teeming town square. The place was so dark and dense with people that she had almost no chance of finding her friends. The air was thick with the smell of cordite from firecrackers, cigarette smoke, beer, and the burned sugar scent of cotton candy from the stalls that had sprung up for the evening, but she could make out almost none of it. Wherever she went, there was a brief, audible intake of breath, and people would back away, frowning and clutching their noses.
Lady, you got sprayed by a skunk,
a freckled youth yelled as she passed him.
You don't say. She answered crossly.
Oh, good Lord.
Two girls pulled back, grimacing at Alice.
Is that Van Cleve's English wife?
Alice felt the people part like waves around her as she drew closer to the stage. It was a minute before she saw him. Bennett was standing over near the corner of the temporary bar, beaming, a Hootapole beer in his hand. She stared at him. At his easy smile, his shoulders loose and relaxed in his good blue shirt. She observed